King, real number 10. How did the peculiar weather conditions in this part of Egypt affect your operational activities?
Well, being so exposed at Saloum, it was greatly interfered with by the sandstorm which came up from the south, what they call the Khamsin. It was a terrific sandstorm, and it used to last perhaps 15 days. At first, you'd see the sky get yellow, and the sun had set very, very yellow. And then gradually you'd find a kind of a mist come along, and then you'd find little puffs of wind. So at last it gradually developed into a terrific gale, and used to come roaring up from the south and carry in the sand, so that you could hardly walk in the face of the wind. Little bits of shell used to fly off the surface and actually cut your knees. All we could do is to get down into our tents, make the aircraft safe and tied down as safe as possible until we had the hangars. And then, one day when they were in the hangars, the Khamsin blew the hangar down as well. But fortunately, the machine was out on the job. It blew the hangar down flat. And that machine, when it came back, had to be picketed out in the open. And the cooks couldn't cook anything. We used to lift on bully beef and biscuits and keep in our tents out of the way. And even if the camels, if they happened to be there, they would crouch down with their back to it. And this Khamsin was a terrible thing. No flying and no activity could take on any more than just barely keeping yourself alive. And if you went to swim in the sea at the same time, the sea was so salt, the time you got back you'd be just as mucky and sticky with all this sand, and it used to get into the engines. You used to have to cover them up very carefully to keep the sand out, but extra cover everywhere. And in that point, there's an amusing incident. We were very strictly rationed with water. Every drop of water we had to come from Alexandria in a ship. And my flight commander hit on the clever idea of indenting for so much water to cool the engines. Well, our engines were air-cooled, but of course the people didn't know anything about that, so we all got extra water, which we put in for, as if it was to cool the engines, when we had the benefit of that. So it used to run, we used to have tea about 3 times a day, and about half a pint of water to wash and do everything else with for those purposes. And the water used to come up on camels. And as soon as they used to have two big tanks, one on either side of the camel, they used to call fantasses. And they used to unload them, and we used to put an armed sentry on them. And that sentry was there day and night. We had a 24-hour sentry looking after those waters to see that no one took any. It was so very, very precious. And as I say, we used to have to wash and clean our teeth and shave and do everything just with a cup full of water.
Now, did you have any contact during this period with the infantry force that was working with you?
Oh, yes. The Cheshires were down below in the bay, but the Welsh were on top with us behind a kind of a sandbank defensive perimeter place. And it happened to be the time of the Welsh Eisteddfod while we were there. So one evening, we all went over to the Welsh camp and all joined in them in singing. We got on extremely well with the Welsh. And just before that, the Boroughs had been in with some beer. And we got some beer which came from the Kaiser Brewery, Bremen. It was a prize the Navy had captured. So we had plenty of beer and plenty of song. And we had a marvellous evening there. And they used to come into their NCOs came into our mess, and we used to go into there, and we cooperated wonderfully well with the infantry there. And one incident happened that when they used to do patrols in the desert, as much for exercise as anything, the general commanding made them keep their equipment bright. And my flight commander, doing the reconnaissance, used to notice that where the infantry were, the brass used to flash in the sun. And he sent in his report that the infantry with their bright equipment, were making themselves a target for anything. And there was quite a bad feeling about that. And the general commanding, I think it was General Dobell, or Murray, I forget which, came to the camp. And they had a real row with Jenkins, then my flight commander. And he said, well, I only report what I see. This bright equipment is showing your men up, and I can see them because this flashes in the sun. The thing was that this man was an old-fashioned spit-and-polish general, and he didn't even stop brightening up his equipment till my flight commander ordered about it. But very soon after, they had to make their equipment dull or not clean it in such a way that it didn't go away their position.
Now, about the middle of May 1916, activities in the Western Desert had quietened down, and B Flight was posted back to the Suez area. Could you describe for me, tell me about what happened to the squadron in the few weeks following that return to the Suez area?
Well, when we got to Suez, we did reconnaissances there in that locality, and went on in a normal way of doing reconnaissances, bomb raids and so on. And then suddenly we were recalled back to Saloum, and we understood that some spy amongst the Arabs had reported that the Senussi were massing another big attack on Saloum. And so we were all sent there, and we went back with the infantry and aircraft and established ourselves in exactly the same place. But after we'd been there some time, the rumour came through that was some misinterpretation of the Arabic, whereby instead of them advancing, they were retiring. And so we flew round a bit and we came back to Suez again. That was really a false rumour. And one quite big ship, the Minnetonka, brought us back, brought us all, evacuated us all together.
And were there any activities, hostile activities, while you were at Solom on the second
day? No, none whatever, no.
Now, after this period with number 14 squadron, you were transferred to a reserve air squadron, number,
yes.
50, number 57.
Yes.
Which I noticed was formed at Ismailia.
Yes.
In December 1916.
Yes.
Can you tell me what you remember about the formation of 57 Reserve and about the activities it carried out?
Well, it was a normal training squadron for flying, not for training personnel, but for flying. And the aircraft we had were mostly Morris Farm and Shorthorns.
It was a station for training flying personnel.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we used to do circuits and bunts with these Morris Farmans. And as the pupils passed out, they went up to another frontline squadron. At the same time, the infantry and other regiments were combed for tradesmen. And we got a lot of these people who were transferred from infantry regiments who had a trade, say like carpenter or plumber or engineer. And they worked as sort of what we would call flight mechanics beside our own men to get used to the working on the aircraft. They didn't have any special training, as far as I can remember. They had to come along and work, and gradually were initiated into the special technical part of it, because they were all tradesmen in their own right, and all they had to do was to learn how to apply their knowledge for whatever was needed to service an aircraft. They were all trained and disciplined men, and that part didn't come into it at all. And so they learned to apply their skill by working with the men who were already skilled, trained flying corps mechanics.
Could you give me some idea of the scale of the training operations at Ismailia?
No, I couldn't very well. All the officers who were, all the men who were trained were all officers. The pilots were all officers from other regiments and transferred. And at the finish, most of the staff were transferred. And just a few Royal Flying Corps people in prominent positions, or...
Now, you were taking part in the instruction of the technical people.
No, at that time, I was acting as a regimental sergeant major. Much to my disgust, I didn't like the job, and I got out of it at the finish, but at the time I was doing all the paperwork. And my sergeants looked after the technical part of it. I had took no part in the technical part at all, and I didn't like that.
You had a desk job.
So I asked for a transfer back to the flights, which I got. And I was just a flight sergeant again until the next transfer to 113 Squadron.
What was Ismailia like?
Always a very pleasant place. It laid on the banks of the Lake Timsa. And Lake Timsa is one of the lakes that forms the chain through which the Suez Canal runs through. And it had been a favourite watering place for civilians beforehand. It was wonderful bathing and a lovely clean place. And everything was very, very pleasant there.
Was it a big station?
No, I think there was only the one squadron there at the time. It wasn't, there didn't seem to be many troops there either. Just our one squadron. There weren't any, not a lot of infantry through there. It was a place that was not very important at that time.
Now, I believe the 57 Reserve Air Squadron was equipped with Morris Farmans.
Yes.
At this stage, the end of 1916, beginning of 1917, these were pretty old aircraft. How did they stand up to the kind of work you put them through?
Well, they were rather dangerous aircraft. I mean, they were not inherently stable, and the trouble was the engine and tanks were at the back of the pilot. So if he made a very bad landing or crash in any way, the engine and tanks usually used to come forward and crush him, and the thing used to set fire. And we saw several very bad accidents there.
Can you remember
yes,
any in particular?
I remember one where I was sitting in the tent having my lunch, and I heard a crash. And I was so used to crashes, I thought, well, this is just one of the usual ones. But anyway, I did come out to look, and there was like a bonfire on the aerodrome. And this thing had set fire. As it crashed, it set fire immediately. And some of the men out there went and dragged the men out, and they laid them near the burning aircraft. And one chap opened his eyes and said, "Oh, take me away from this fire." And we lifted him away from the fire, and he died immediately. And that was the case. Nearly the machine nearly always set fire when they crashed, but these two both died. Although the men got them out, they were already, you know, on the point of death. And one or two accidents happened the same way. It really was an unfortunate squadron for crashes, as I remember it.
Now, in the autumn of 1917, you successfully applied for transfer to a new squadron, which was being formed at that time. That was 113 Squadron.
Yeah.
Tell me what you can remember about the growth of this squadron from the time you joined it and the way in which it trained and developed at Ismailia in preparation for operations in Palestine.
Yes, well, as I was transferred to 113, I was the senior NCO, and we first of all got a flight together with one or two odd aircraft, B2Cs, I think, and men came in gradually, and we got to two flights, and then three flights, till in some matter of weeks the squadron was fully equipped. And then we had, soon after the beginning of the squadron, we had the RE8 type machine came out from England, and that was a different type altogether to the BBC or Morris or anything like that. And so the pilots who were transfers from other squadrons They had to get used to it. So we had a period of the flying of the RE-8s and special and gunnery practice with a scarf gun ring before we moved up. And we spent some weeks, the men getting used to the aircraft and the pilots getting used to them, before we moved further up into Palestine as a complete unit.